Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026, we are delighted to host this discussion with Timothy Sandifer, on his new book entitled Proclaiming Liberty, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and the Declaration of Independence. My name is DJ Hall, and I'm a rising 3L at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School, currently serving as a student liaison with the Federalist Society Property Rights Practice Group. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Today, we are grateful to have Professor Lee Strang with us to lead the conversation. Professor Strang is a professor of law and the inaugural executive director of the Salmon P. Chase Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at The Ohio State University. One last note is throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and in with a question mark. That is always helpful for our speakers. With that, thank you for being with us today. And Professor Strang, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you, DJ. I'm really delighted to introduce Tim and his wonderful new book. And so my role is to introduce Tim's professional background, his many accomplishments, to give him an opportunity to give a brief summary of the book as a teaser for the audience members who haven't yet read it. And then for Tim and I will engage in a conversation and open up the conversation more broadly to our audience members. So Timothy Sandifer is the Vice President for Legal Affairs at the Goldwater Institute's Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation and holds the Duncan Chair in Constitutional Government. He litigates to promote economic liberty, private property rights, free speech, and other crucial values in states across the country. Timothy is the author of 9 books, that's a lot of books, and in addition to dozens of articles, nearly 50 articles on a wide variety of legal subjects. And I personally have benefited from reading Tim's scholarship and have been enriched by it. And today's book is no exception to that. A frequent guest on radio and television, Tim's writings have appeared in Reason, National Review, Weekly Standard, Wall Street Journal, and The Objective Standard, where he's a contributing editor. Timothy has taught classes at Pepperdine University, McGeorge School of Law, George Mason University's Antonin Scalia School of Law, and Arizona State University, where he held the 2023-2024 Barry Goldwater Chair in American Institutions. He's an adjunct scholar with the Cato Institute and is a graduate of Hillsdale College and Chapman University School of Law. Tim's most recent book, the topic of our conversation today, is Proclaiming Liberty. It's a perfect book for the time period, not just in the sense of the chronology of the 250th anniversary of the founding of our country, but in a more substantive way about reminding us Americans about the things that we hold in common and the particular unique founding moment and the founding principles of our Constitutional Republic. It's a readable book. It's accessible to educated laypersons. It's accessible and enriching to scholars. It's provocatively and winsomely argued as well. And so there are many really interesting ways that Tim presents his information. One example is the background genealogy of different portions and texts in the Declaration of Independence. Tim does a really good job with that. So as I said, Tim is going to start us off with a few minutes of introduction, and then we'll have a conversation together. Tim?
Well, thank you. You very much. Thank you so much. And thank you for doing this. And I want to start by returning the compliment and saying that I know that you and I have some disagreements about the Declaration on certain topics, but I have always admired your scholarship and particularly your writings on substantive due process, which I think is a subject that a lot of scholars get wrong today. And so I've always learned a lot from your work. The book I set out to write a book that would go through the Declaration line by line and explain what it's all referring to. Because I think, you know, every July 4th, we read the Declaration and there's that long list of grievances against the British government, and they're not very specific. And I think a lot of people today don't know exactly what they refer to. So that was one goal, was to go line by line and explain those. And of course, to be fair to the philosophical background of the Declaration, there's a lot of historians, especially mid-20th century historians, who kind of poo-pooed the philosophical ideas of the Declaration, natural rights and natural law, and even claim that the founders didn't really mean it, which I think is really silly. So I wanted to defend that. But I also wanted to talk about the century before the Declaration. I think a lot of Americans today are not familiar with the tensions that went on between the first founding of the first colonies in the early 17th century and the beginning of the crisis that led to the revolution in the 1760s. There's a century and a half there of conflict and debate between the Americans and their British cousins about who exactly is in charge of what. And some of that got pretty nasty. And I think a lot of Americans don't know that story. So I wanted to put that in there. But I also didn't want it to be the book to be a dry recitation of historical facts or philosophical points. So I also wanted to tell it in the form of the friendship between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson that led up to the writing of the Declaration of Independence, which has the convenient element that I then don't have to talk about their arguments later on in life, which is certainly a book in itself. And many books on that topic have already been written. And then I conclude, of course, with how the Declaration has affected Americans historically since the Revolution, the Civil War era, the Progressive era, today, and, you know, with the recent 1619 Project and what that says about, as you put it, the things that we Americans have in common that are enunciated in the Declaration.
Thank you, Tim. That was very pithy. So you had graciously had pointed out, and we have an audience of lawyers, and so one of the questions or debates over the Declaration, past, present, and likely in the future, will be the Declaration's legal status. And you had pointed out that one of the points about which people disagree, including I think you and I, had been on that. And so I wanted to give you a chance first to describe your position about what is the status of the Declaration as a legal document, and then I'll have some follow-up questions on that if you don't mind.
Yeah, so this debate, at least as far as I'm concerned, it began with the work of Robert Bork, who was for a long time one of the most important conservative intellectuals in the country. And he, along with sort of this traditionalist branch of American conservatism, and I'm thinking about people like Russell Kirk, for example, they had a real problem with the Declaration of Independence. And the reason is philosophical, and that is that the Declaration is written based on abstract philosophical principles. And there's a strain of conservative thought led by Russell Kirk and others who claim that that's a bad thing in and of itself, and that conservatism ought to prioritize tradition and hierarchy and habit over abstract philosophical principles. Well, if you believe that, what do you do with the Declaration? And so a lot of them have argued, well, just ignore the Declaration. Russell Kirk, for example, or Irving Kristol, or Martin Diamond. These writers said, well, you should just ignore the Declaration. It wasn't really all that important, or it was really written to impress the French. And I argue to the contrary, that not only is the Declaration central to understanding the Revolution, but that it forms a part of American law. At her confirmation hearings, Justice Barrett was asked, is the Declaration of Independence law? And she answered no. And I think that's completely wrong. I think, of course, the Declaration of Independence is law. It was adopted by what was then the legislature of the country. It is found in the statute books to this day, both in the U.S. Code and in the statutes at large. It had legal consequences. It's referred to in the Constitution of the United States. I think it is a law. I think the real debate is over what do we mean by the term law? And I think modern lawyers, under the influence of positivist 20th century thinkers like Oliver Wendell Holmes, think that a law has to be backed up by punishments. It has to command something and be backed up by punishments. And on the contrary, in fact, there's quite a lot of laws that are neither commanding anybody nor backed up by punishments. The Ninth and Tenth Amendments, for example, are definitely law, but they don't command anything. except that the Ninth Amendment does command federal judges not to read the Constitution the way that most federal judges today do read the Constitution. Other than that, there's still law. So I see no reason why we should not acknowledge the Declaration as being one of the organic laws of the United States, which there's four of those. That's the Declaration, the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, and the Northwest Ordinance. And those play the role, among other things, of teaching us how to interpret the Constitution, exactly the role that the Ninth and Tenth Amendments play.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. And I want to get into some of the arguments that you had just given now, but also in the book. You give a very pithy summary of some of the arguments in your book about the reasons for your position that the Declaration has legal status. I wanted to just spend a little bit more time focusing on one aspect that you had mentioned here, but also comes up in the book. And that is, given the Declaration's, from your perspective, legal status, how precisely does it influence constitutional interpretation? So you, for example, talk about, among many other examples, Lochner versus New York, and you praise, I think, the majority criticized Justice Holmes, who also came up for criticism in your remarks here. And so maybe share with our audience, if one is an officer whose job it is to faithfully interpret the Constitution, what role does Declaration play in their legal reasoning as doing it? And so Lochner dealt with the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, but I also would love to hear from you about, let's say there's an Interstate Commerce Clause case, how might the Declaration play a role there from your perspective?
That's a great question. Let's start with Lochner, which is the easier part of your question. So Lochner, of course, is we're all supposed to hate Lochner. We're all supposed to think that Lochner was wrongly decided. In fact, Lochner was correctly decided. And Lochner is a 1906 case that says, or 1905 case that says that you have a constitutionally protected right to earn a living without unreasonable government interference. I'm a big fan of Lochner. In fact, my license plate is the case citation for Lochner 1998. Can you believe that it was not already taken? When I picked it up at the DMV, the lady said, "What is this?" And I explained. I said, "Well, it's a Supreme Court case. It says you have a right to earn a living and that the government can't take that away from you." And she says, "But they do so all the time." And I said, "Aha." Anyway, the role the Declaration plays in that is the Declaration refers to our right to pursue happiness. What is the right to pursue happiness? And how is that embedded in the Constitution? Well, the Constitution protects our right to liberty. By the way, this is an important point for our audience, and that is when you hear the term unenumerated rights, you should immediately be skeptical, because in fact, the Constitution does enumerate all of our rights. The Constitution says that liberty is an enumerated right, and the word liberty literally refers to an infinite number of rights. And so it is not the case that our rights are unenumerated. Our rights are enumerated because they are part of liberty, and all rights, including my right to wear a hat, or right now I'm fiddling with my wedding ring. Do I have a constitutional right to do that? Of course I do, because it's part of my liberty that is protected by the 14th Amendment. And if the government were to try to take that freedom away from me for no good reason, it would be violating my rights to due process of law. The right to pursue happiness, as referred to in the Declaration, when you look into the history, as I do in my book, refers specifically to the right to economic freedom, the right to use your knowledge and skills to provide for yourself and your family as you see fit without unreasonable interference by the government. And so that is embedded in the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. So of course the court was correct to say that if the government takes away your right to decide for yourself what jobs to take, what pay to accept, what hours to work, that there has to at least be a good reason for that. And if there's no good reason for it, it violates your right to due process of law. So that's how the Declaration informs our constitutional understanding, at least as far as liberty is concerned. Commerce might be a little bit more difficult. The reason why is because, there's a marvelous legal historian named John Philip Reed, just died a couple years ago. He published a 4-volume legal history of the American Revolution. And he and Jack Green, another historian of the subject, point out that really the problem was that the British Empire did not have the concept of federalism. It was in its birth at that time. It hadn't originated. And that really was the central problem that led to the imperial crisis. And the terms like commerce and things like that, I think, represent the founding generation's effort to come up with a system that would have a central government in charge of truly national commercial concerns while leaving to the states the authority to control their own domestic policies. in that, of course, the declaration probably won't be that much help in deciding a case like, you know, New York versus United States or something like that, or Lopez versus United States. But it's not supposed to, right? The declaration is a broad philosophical framework that enunciates the problems that led to the revolution. You don't expect it to instruct you on, you know, whether 55 or 65 should be the speed limit, you know.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that nuanced response, Tim. And one kind of follow-up question. So one might hear you saying, given your distinction between, let's say, liberty and the 14th Amendment and the Interstate Commerce Clause, and in one, the Declaration plays a robust role, your argument was, and the other, it plays a less robust role. And the sources that you relied on to support that were the background historical information feeding into those respective propositions. And it's not that the Declaration was silent to either of those, but it had the most input on the former, the liberty. Right. And so maybe for our audience, how is that analysis that you just went through different than different versions of originalism that are out there? Or maybe it is a version of originalism. Is there place where you're at in that pantheon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've just recently published an article in the New York Journal of Law and Liberty explaining why I don't consider myself an originalist.
Yeah.
And
which is why the question, because those were original sounding responses.
Right. And I do love the history, and I do think it's very important to understand the text. But I don't think that the reason basically is that I don't think legal meaning is created by a historical fact. And for that reason, the origin of law, to my mind, does not vest it with meaning. It might give it something else. It might give law its binding force in some way. But if so, then that means that we are obligated to follow the law for our own reasons and not because of our ancestors. Or as Thomas Jefferson famously said, the world belongs to the living and not the dead. So for those reasons, I'm not an originalist. However, I do think that I think probably the best way to say is that the law is like a found object. You know, in my article, I use an example. Not long ago, they found this ancient Greek machine. The Anticlerithos, or I'm going to muddle up the name of it. But anyway, this device, which apparently was some kind of a calendar. Well, when it was found, it was all broken up and encrusted with all sorts of, 'cause it had been in the ocean for millennia or something. How do you figure out what this thing is? You don't ask, well, what did the founding fathers think that it was? No, you ask what it actually is. You ask about its mechanisms and how it operates. Now, one factor in that would indeed be the intentions of the designers, but that's just one factor. It's not like the definitive thing. If it was intended to be a hammer, that doesn't mean that it's a hammer. It's still a calendar, even if its makers had thought that it was a hammer, right? So these are all philosophical subtleties, because the bottom line is that I ultimately find myself in agreement with originalists on in the outcomes of cases most of the time. But I don't think that we're bound to those things by the framers' intent. And so, yes, you look at the Declaration, you look at the problems that the Constitution was intended to solve, and those are often explained in the Declaration. And those things guide your constitutional interpretation. But most of all, it's the classical liberal political philosophy enunciated in the Declaration. And this, I think, is probably the most important point in the book to me, which is you've heard a lot of talk recently about so-called common good constitutionalism. And the people who advocate this say, well, the Constitution is not a morally neutral framework. It has to have a moral compass to it. And they're right about that. Where they go wrong is in their belief that that moral compass is the catechism of the Catholic Church. Actually, the moral compass is the classical liberal political philosophy enunciated in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. Thank you. So you had given in your remarks here, Tim, just briefly, and then more extended in your book, some of the reasons to consider the Declaration a legal document or a legal set of legal propositions. One of those you just mentioned in our conversation today, and it was that the Declaration was a statute passed by the Continental Congress. And, you know, I was thinking in terms of Article 6, Clause 2. And the list of things that seem to count as the law, at least, you know, things that are superior to other forms of law, doesn't include things passed by the Continental Congress. And so within the framework of the U.S. Constitution, I assume you agree with Article 6, Clause 2, how does the status of the Declaration as being a statute passed by the Continental Congress relevant to whether it's law today?
That's a great question. So there are a lot of things that were passed by the Continental Congress that remain law today. The most prominent one is probably the Uniform Code of Military Justice incorporates provisions of the Articles of War that were adopted by the Continental Congress, and those remain law today. Now, one could say, well, yes, but they were readopted in some way. I don't know if that's
true.
That is
actually what I was going to say.
Yeah,
to
you, okay. Yes. I didn't know if that was historically the fact. But then I would...
And same with the Northwest Ordinance, right? So the Northwest Ordinance was passed, but then it was repassed in the first session of the first Congress.
Yeah. And I would contend that even if it had not been done in name, that I think at this point one would be stopped from denying that Congress had readopted the Declaration of Independence. I would also point that the Declaration of Independence ends with a reference to the Declaration. I mean, the Constitution ends with a reference to the Declaration when it says, done in the year of our Lord, 1787, and in the independence of the United States and so forth. It was certainly the common understanding at the time and remains a common understanding today. And I don't think anybody has ever disputed that the Declaration of Independence did indeed declare the United States to be independent mm-hmm. and continues to do so today. So I think it would be difficult to argue at this stage that the Declaration somehow ceased to be law upon the adoption of the Constitution. Now, on this point, of course, we're being a little bit facetious, I think, because we're talking about a messy historical record that includes, among other things, the Civil War. Right. And one of the big points of the Civil War was this issue over sovereignty. And where is sovereignty in the constitutional scheme? Is it in the Union as a whole? Do the states somehow inherit the sovereignty directly from Parliament on July 4th, 1776, which was what the Southerners argued in the run-up to the Civil War? And the answer is that there was a good deal of vagueness about that during the founding era. First of all, they're in the middle of a war. They don't have time to have these kinds of debates. Secondly, for political reasons, it was really dangerous to have those kinds of debates early on in American history. And so you find inconsistent statements such as, what is it, Article 3, I think, of the Articles of Confederation that says each state retains its sovereignty, right? Right. And so... I think constitutional scholars have debated this ever since over when exactly can we say that the nation as a whole became a sovereign entity. And Lincoln had one view, you know, which I've called the early sovereignty view, which was that it was on July 4, 1776, that the nation became sovereign. And in fact, he pointed out that he argued that the states had been created by the federal government. The reason being that Continental Congress instructed the states to write state constitutions. And this is the exact opposite of the Southern argument, which was that the states had created the federal government, right? Which was, alas and alack, quoted verbatim by Ronald Reagan in his first inaugural address. And it is completely incorrect. It is literally false that the states created the federal government. I think we can all at least agree on that. Then there's Madison's position. He's kind of in the middle there, and he has this sort of, well, it was a little of this, a little of that kind of an argument that, well, it was created by the people in their highest sovereign capacity, but not in states, but not of states. It's really kind of complicated. I think Madison probably was right, but I think at this stage, with the ratification of the 14th Amendment especially, it's kind of, dare I say, academic to have those kinds of disputes.
Yeah. So is it your view that it's not until Grant versus Lee at the Appomattox Courthouse that that question was finally settled for the United States?
I would say it was finally settled with the adoption of the Reconstruction Amendments. I think okay. The 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment does these amazing things. And there does one thing that a lot of people comment on, and that is in the first sentence, which, this birthright citizenship is a big issue right now. I'm not talking about that. In the first sentence, it says all persons born and naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state where they reside. Now, putting aside birthright citizenship, what does that phrase do? What it does is it takes away the state's ability to define their own citizenship. So when I moved from California to Arizona a decade ago, I became an Arizonan whether Arizona liked it or not. Right. And that's really quite remarkable. And I don't think you can be a sovereign if you can't define your own citizens. And no state can define its own citizens because of the 14th Amendment. I think if nothing else, I think that has to have put the final nail in the coffin of any doubt about federal sovereignty.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one that I think you're right, at least until recently, was underappreciated. Like who decided citizenship? And
yeah, it's really amazing, isn't it, that until 1868, the U.S. Constitution did not define citizen at all. That's really amazing. And it led to all sorts of trouble, as I talk about in that book and in the new book, as well as in my previous book, The Conscience of the Constitution.
So, Tim, you had mentioned in our conversation so far some of the arguments for or against the legal status of the Declaration of Independence. And one of the ones that you would also mention, both in your book and in your remarks today, were criticisms of the claim that the Declaration could be law because it doesn't have, you had mentioned, the Holmesian coercion view of law. There's maybe a slightly different version of that that I wanted to raise and get your response to. So one of the things I love about your book, as I had mentioned earlier, was that you'll have a sentence or a clause of the Declaration, and you'll go and give a genealogy, you'll give background to that, and very powerfully done, very well done, very accessible. But then at the end, and this is on page 399, it kind of struck me because you would, in a paragraph, talk about state courts using the Declaration of Independence, and then you have a paragraph on 399 where you say, there's this question about abortion, and you have, like, on the one hand, there could be an interpretation X, another hand, it could be interpretation not X, or, you know, X and Y, whatever it might be. And then you say, hey, this book can't handle that.
Right.
I kind of wondered about that. And here's why. Right. So it could be the case that Holmes had the incorrect view of law, kind of in big picture, but it could be correct that he had an insight into what law does, which is it gives people sufficient guidance for the practical reason to be coordinated with other citizens in the Republic. And one criticism that people have given of the Declaration is that you've got Tim Sandifer, who's like, it protects property rights. You've got this other person who says it doesn't protect property rights. And, you know, so there's lots of different interpretations. And I definitely don't want to fall into the trap of saying, because of disagreement, there's no truth of the matter, right? That is not the claim I'm making here.
Sure.
But it just struck me that after the confidence and the fulsomeness with which you describe so much of the Declaration of Independence, there's this other really important issue where you're like, not addressing that. Does it give the critics ammunition that the Declaration actually doesn't have enough guidance to be law?
I suppose it's possible. And if so, then I regret that. The primary reason was because of something else you said. You said it was on page 399. by that point, I had written enough and I didn't want to get into it about abortion. Sure. I definitely have views about how the Declaration's propositions apply to that issue. I think the Kansas Supreme Court got it right. And the reason why state courts are important, by the way, for those who have not yet read the book, notice I say not yet read the book, is that a lot of state constitutions use the same kind of language that the Declaration of Independence uses. And some of these are modeled on the Declaration of Independence. And so in recent years, state courts, in interpreting their state constitutions to determine what the scope of liberty is as protected by their state constitutions, have had to inquire into this classical liberal political philosophy that underlies both their state bills of rights and the Declaration of Independence. And I think it's a very healthy development, regardless of one's views about abortion. I think it's a really good thing that our state courts are being, I was going to say, forced to confront what their state constitutions actually say, instead of sort of, you know, delegate or deferring to what the federal courts say, which they've done so long. And it's been really to the detriment of state constitutional law. So I do think that there is a right answer to that question. And maybe someday I'll write a book about it.
Sure. Great, great answer. And, you know, and I also want to highlight, so I know Ohio was one of the states that was listed there. And in Ohio, we've had a real resurgence in our state Supreme Court taking ownership of our state constitution. And not just that issue, but in kind of many, many other issues. Last question related to the legal status of the Declaration. So we've talked about the way in which, in your view, the Declaration interacts with the Constitution. We've talked about the reasons that you've given for why it has legal status. You know, what would be the negative consequence? Let's say somebody, for whatever reason, isn't persuaded yet. What's the negative consequence of the Declaration not having legal status? Let's say that all the things you said that were true, it's a statement of true political propositions about our political community, a statement of true propositions regarding us as individual human beings. And so it seems like, in fact, there could be ways in which it not being a legal document might be advantageous. For example, it would mean that that citizens could use the Declaration, which is these founding statements of political principle, to critique current law and try to move current law. It could be judicial, it could be legislative, whatever it might be, in the direction of the Declaration as you've articulated. So what's the harm of it not being legal?
Maybe I misunderstood your question, but are you saying that it can't play that role if it is law? I mean, it seems to me that the law can often say, well, here's the purpose of such and such, and so you can use the law to critique itself, right?
Totally. I guess, but maybe I'll just flip it around. What do I gain if I accept your proposition that the Declaration is law in kind of, I think by your own characterization, a special way, or I don't want to say unusual, but kind of an interesting way, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for one thing, you'd see that Lochner was rightly decided. And what I mean by that, and I'm saying that only slightly facetiously, what I mean is I think that failing to appreciate the Declaration's status as law lends credence to this positivist notion that the Constitution is designed to allow the majority to decide what rights we get to enjoy, which unfortunately I think is the dominant view among judges today, including those who profess at times to believe in natural rights. I would point to Justice Scalia, for example, who was incredibly skeptical of rights claims because his primary fear was activist courts. Well, I'm far, far less worried about activist courts than I am about activist legislatures. Legislatures are far more likely to take away your freedoms. In fact, they do so every second of every day in every state of this country. And unfortunately, the majority of the time, courts refuse to do anything about it. And the reason why courts tend to refuse to do anything about it is because they've adopted this progressivist notion, falsely masquerading as a conservative notion, that judicial deference is a good thing, or that courts should not be activists, which is to say courts should be passive and therefore should fail to protect you when your rights are being violated by the government. I think if we recognize the Declaration's legal status, that helps reinforce the proposition that the purpose of government is to protect individual liberty. Incidentally, on this subject, I have a new article coming out in the Journal of Law and Politics on purpose of government clauses in state constitutions. Mm-hmm. And I was intrigued enough to write this article because the Arizona Constitution specifies the purpose of government is the protection of individual rights. And Arizona and Washington are the only states that have that particular phrase in their constitutions. And in fact, they, along with Louisiana, are the only constitutions in the country, and I think possibly in the world, that use the phrase individual rights. And part of the reason why is the influence of classical liberal thinking, especially in the wake of the Civil War. I get into that in a lot more detail in my article. So my point is that if the Declaration's legal status is respected, I think it lends more weight to what I think is the proper outcome, which is that the Constitution's primary purpose is to protect us against majorities, not to facilitate the government in molding and shaping society into the shape that that our political elites want it to be.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. And then just as an aside, I wonder what you think about this, and you had rightly referenced Justice Scalia. I remember in his Glucksberg, I think it was concurrence, where he basically articulated the point that you had just made, which was Declaration articulates true propositions, but me as a judge, I'm not the person to enforce it. Do you think that the experience of COVID and legislative, executive, and other restrictions imposed during that time period have pushed people who might share Justice Scalia's ideological perspective away from the position that he had articulated regarding the role of judges being more passive? I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's possible, but I don't think it's not the only reason. I think there's been a critique of the conservative judicial restraint theory going on for quite a while. I remember, 10 years ago or something, that Randy Barnett engaged in a debate at the Federalist Society annual conference in D.C. with a federal judge, I don't remember who it was, and on this question of judicial restraint. And when it was over, apparently they polled the audience, and the audience was pretty much not on the judicial restraint side, from what I understand. Okay. I wasn't there myself. But yeah. I think there's been a couple of things. I think that the rising generation of legal scholars today who went to law school when I was in law school, they've had the weaknesses of the judicial restraint view pointed out to them over time. And that combined with the abuses that we've seen seen in COVID and in other cases, I think, or take things like Kelo. You know, the Kelo decision is such an obviously wrong decision, such a perfect example of judicial restraint and what everything that's wrong with judicial restraint. I think things like that have, I hope, have pushed people to demand a more engaged judiciary, one that will stop just letting the Constitution die of disuse.
Yeah, but they're good, very good points. So one of the points that you had made both in the book and then in your remarks was identifying the origin of what you described as scholars and others who didn't view the Declaration as having legal status, but also maybe more broadly, and this is the reference to Russell Kirk, both here and then in your book, he comes up a number of times as, and I thought this was a great move, right? Kirk said conservatism equals concreteness. Declaration is abstract. Therefore, we don't like the Declaration. So I thought that was a very powerful move. So one of the themes of the book, and tell me if I'm mischaracterizing it, is that the Declaration commits us to these principles of political morality as a political community. So a human equality would be one, but not the only example. What would you say about historians like Kirk, but maybe others like Forrest MacDonald, who, in Kirk's words, they viewed the Declaration and the Revolution as a revolution avoided, and for some of the reasons that you address in your book, and you criticize the view because at least some aspects of that view, where the Declaration's claims, you argue, and I think rightly so, were true claims, meant to be true by their authors, and in fact are true claims of political morality. But I wonder. So, for example, one of the things that MacDonald pointed out in his book, New Order of the Ages, Novus Ordo Secularum, was the deep continuing influence of the common law in the American political community, which I think you would agree with and be on board with for many reasons. And so, my question is, why can't it be both and? Why can't it be both a break and a statement of political principle and deep continuity? That might acknowledge the Kirk-McDonald position. So what are your thoughts about
that? Yeah, no, actually, I think I agree with that. Okay. And actually, by the way, I'll point out that this kind of goes back to your first question, or one of your first questions, when you asked about the Declaration and Article 6 of the Constitution, which is the Constitution also... It just inherently absorbs some of the legal atmosphere of the time, you might say. It doesn't refer to the common law. The common law is referred to in the Bill of Rights, but that was ratified afterwards. Mm-hmm. So the Constitution itself doesn't—and it doesn't define terms like property and things like that, because it assumes that those principles from the common law background are absorbed into the Constitution. I would say the same is true of the Declaration. But yes, it's funny because I dedicate the book to Harry Jaffa, who was a big influence on me. When I was in just first starting to go to college, I got to know him before I went off to college, and we corresponded for many years. And he was a huge influence on how I understand the American Revolution. Although I am by no means a Straussian myself, but
which would be okay if you were, Tim.
Well, of course, that's just what I tell people. Esoterically. Anyway,
that's good.
What's the old joke? How many Straussians does it take to change a light bulb? None. The light bulb has more significance due to the darkness. But anyway, so that has been a big influence on me in seeing the Declaration and the Revolution as very radical. And I'm very much of the view that the Lockean philosophical element is primary here. But also, it is true that there was a lot of practical, pragmatic concerns about how we are living our daily lives that were at the heart of the Revolution. And so, though I do think that we reconcile them, and the way to do that is this: to say between 1764 and 1776, and 1764 being the beginning of the crisis that led to the Revolution, during that period, Americans were largely focused on those pragmatic considerations, what we say the right, traditional rights of Englishmen. And it was only beginning in the early 1776 that there was this shift in public attitude to saying, fine, we've had it. We're no longer English. We no longer lay claim to the rights, our traditional rights as Englishmen. Instead, we're laying our foundations on political philosophy. And that's why the Declaration doesn't refer to the common law. John Philip Reed, I discussed this in a lengthy endnote in my book, John Philip Reed tried to make the argument that it does, and it really does not. The closest is it refers to the trial by jury, which of course is a common law right and not a natural right, but it notably does not say the right to trial by jury. It says the privilege of trial by jury. And it's saying that because trial by jury is important for protecting our natural rights. So I do think there's a big break mistake there. But of course, absolutely, it incorporates the common law background that everybody was so familiar with, and it and the Constitution assume a familiarity with the Anglo-American common law. I'll put in a footnote to say one amusing thing that I discovered in writing the book was that Thomas Jefferson argued that American judges should be forbidden from citing British court rulings dating from the 1750s when Lord Mansfield became Chief Justice of England, because Jefferson hated Lord Mansfield so intensely, because Lord Mansfield was this very pro-Parliament, you know, very anti-revolution guy, that Jefferson thought that American judges should not be allowed to cite opinions dating from the time at which he became Chief Justice of England.
Jefferson was a man of passion.
Yes, he was.
So moving to some of your claims regarding the Declaration's substance. So at one point, or on page 335, you are describing the Declaration of Independence conception of government, and you claim, quote, preserving individual freedom is the only truly common political good. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to expound on that if you wanted. And here's what I had in mind. Am I reading that right, where that is the entirety of the common good of the American political community? Or are there other things? And like one other thing, something that might, and I think would be amenable to what we've talked about today, one might say that the common good are those things that Americans hold in common and that are in fact good. And so the rule of law might be something that would be both common and good, and consistent, I think, with your claims regarding the Declaration of Independence. So I want to give you a chance to describe what you understand by the common good.
Yeah, and I think the short answer is yes, of course, the rule of law would be one of those things that does serve the common good because it serves to protect individual rights. But
so it's just instrumental. It itself would not be. Okay, I understand.
I think that's right. I think that's right. I get that from James Madison, who was directly asked this question about the common good, and his answer was that the only thing that is truly in everybody's interest is the protection of individual rights. Otherwise, you're in a situation where you're taking from some and giving to others, and you open yourself up to the rent-seeking phenomena. Now, there comes the challenge from my anarcho-capitalist friends who would argue, like Anthony de Jassé, who I think makes a powerful argument in his book, Justice and Its Surroundings, that all government inevitably is redistributive because, you know, the James Bond villain who can afford his own private army, he doesn't need the police to protect him. He's got his own private army. So when you tax him to pay for the police to protect me, well, then that's inherently redistributive. And so he argues that the only government that could possibly satisfy this common good standard would be no government at all. And I think that's a powerful critique, one I don't have an answer to. But I do think that in the end, your choice is between a government that protects individual rights or a government that redistributes wealth and thereby violates everybody's rights. Or as Jefferson put it much more eloquently than I can, the sum of good government is one which shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned.
Okay. Again, looking at some of the claims regarding the Declaration. So you argued, Tim, and I thought did a great job of describing from your perspective, what did self-evident mean? And self-evident didn't mean things that might be caricatures, at least in some subsequent scholars have described it as. I want to give you a chance to elaborate on what you meant by self-evident. And in particular, you talked about the self-evidence of human equality and natural rights. And I thought had many good moves there. But the reason why I'm raising it, and you have a very powerful claim, right? And this is what struck me. It's your conception of self-evidence is one where most thinking people, most people who have engaged in life would come to see that these propositions are true. And it, you know, having as somebody who I was just reading, there's an account of the conquest of Mexico with Cortez. And I'm not accounting for the veracity of all of the characterizations in the account of the way Aztecs treated other human beings. But if at least some of it's true, it seems like there was a political community that did not view some of the things you're claiming, such as human equality, as self-evident. So I wanted to give you a chance to expound on self-evidence. And then how do you account for cultures? And maybe the answer is I'm just mischaracterizing the culture, but it seems like there are cultures who did not see the self-evidence that you're seeing.
Oh, yeah. No, there certainly were. And in fact, of course, one would point to American slavery and say that even Americans in practice as a de facto matter did not recognize and follow that principle at the time of the founding. And by the classical liberal lights of the Declaration, they are, insofar as they fail to acknowledge that equality, illegitimate political rule. And I'm reminded of a line. Jefferson writes a letter to somebody who was asking about these issues. And Jefferson commented that Thomas Hobbes mistook the abusive for the natural state of man. And that distinction between the abusive state, which can be historically the most common, and in fact is historically the most common, and the natural state, in the way that that classical liberalism uses that term natural, which is sort of normatively loaded, would be that indeed you do find many, if not most, societies that ignore the self-evident truths and to that extent are illegitimate, with the ideal being some sort of perfect society that where people always respected that principle.
Tim, I guess the one thing I want to say is that by the account, again, this is of the outsiders, it didn't seem like they recognized. It wasn't that they knew that the non-Aztec Mexicans were human. It's like they actually just didn't think that those folks, they may be of the species Homo sapiens, but they don't deserve equality.
Right. I'm tempted to invoke a religious metaphor here and say that such people would be in the situation of the figures who are in Dante's limbo, right? Who are not damned to hell, but are also not entitled to heaven because they lived before Jesus. So they just didn't have the chance. Right.
Okay.
And by the way, it's inevitable to fall into metaphor here. As I argue in the conclusion of my book, that all political theory to some degree ends up in metaphor. And that's not a bad thing. It's just that's how we think about these issues. And that's how we invoke things like loyalty and other political / legal values are inevitably based on metaphor to some extent. Self-evidence is a tough proposition, and I owe a lot of what I understand on this principle to our mutual friend Brad Thompson at Clemson University, who's the author of a fantastic book about the revolution called The American Mind. And that is self-evidence means something that is clear to a person who is familiar and mature enough and familiar enough with the language to know what the words are referring to. So it is not self-evident that when a rock is dropped, it will go toward the earth at the gravitational rate of a certain number of feet per second, et cetera. But it is self-evident that it will fall, because anybody who has enough familiarity with life knows that it will do so. And there are not only facts that are self-evident, but rules and principles are self-evident also. So the golden rule is self-evident because it says other people are like me. They, like me, will resent wrongs and appreciate good things, and therefore I should treat people as I would want them to treat me. And in fact, embedded into the golden rule is the proposition all men are created equal, because the proposition that other people are like me is that all men are created equal. And this argument is not original to me. This is in fact what Locke argues. He quotes Richard Hooker in the Second Treatise on this subject. And when you read Richard Hooker, he's saying the golden rule is a self-evident fact of human life.
Thank you, Tim. And we've had a rich conversation now for almost 45, a little bit over 45 minutes. I wanted to invite DJ back into the conversation because I know we have a number of audience members. DJ, are there questions from the audience for Tim?
There definitely are. And thank you both so much for that. It seems to have prompted some pretty great questions. So we'll go ahead and start off with one, which Blake is asking, which document is more legally relevant to the establishment of the nation? The Declaration of Independence, when we unilaterally declared nationhood, or the Treaty of Paris in 1783, when the Crown agreed to it?
I would argue that it is the unilateral declaration, that the declaration makes it a fait accompli. And in fact, the declaration, you could even quibble over this. The declaration says it's acquiescing in the necessity. And what it means by that is the authors of the declaration don't say that they are the ones who are so to speak, the plaintiffs in the matter. They say that they have had independence thrust upon them, that the king has proclaimed us outside of his protection, and that dissolves our political union with Great Britain. And Americans are simply recognizing that accomplished fact. So you could say that independence comes sometime before the Declaration. The Declaration is simply pronouncing a thing that has already occurred. Incidentally, John Adams, I can hear him already in my head. John Adams would have insisted that it was his resolution that actually accomplished independence, his resolution being the resolution calling on the states to create new constitutions. The preamble that Adams wrote for that resolution says that the states must write their own constitutions that make no reference to loyalty to the king or the authority of the monarchy. And as a matter of practical reality, that was independence, or at least that's what Adams claimed. And, you know, I think with good reason.
Thank you. And then as sort of a follow-up to that, what implications does the unilateral ability to declare separation from a sovereign have on our understanding of the Confederacy's attempt to do so in the early 1860s?
Well, you know, Professor Strang mentioned my next book should be about abortion. After that, maybe I'll write one about the Civil War. So today there's a lot of you occasionally encounter people who say, well, the Declaration of Independence set this principle that it's OK to separate from a political system. And therefore, the southern states were legitimately declaring their independence from the United States in 1861. And that's a very hasty and, in fact, fallacious way of viewing things. The Declaration, for one thing, the Declaration says that declaring independence is only legitimate after a long train of abuses have evidenced a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism, which was certainly not the case in 1861. Secondly, the Declaration makes no pretense that the state can secede and kidnap millions of people against their will, which, of course, is what the southern states were trying to do in 1861. Also, the Declaration proclaims liberty and equality as the foundational political value and the authorizing value of independence, whereas, of course, the Confederate states were doing exactly the opposite. But most importantly, one has to keep in mind the difference between secession and leaving and other forms of leaving a political entity. So I can quit a social club because I'm an individual member of that club and I can quit it anytime I want. That's not true of the states in the Union. We were talking about the early versus late sovereignty and the location of sovereignty of the federal government. According to the Madisonian and Lincolnian view, sovereignty between in the state and sovereignty in the federal government are completely different things. Just like I have to pay a different bill to the electric company and to the water company. And I can't tell the water company, well, you know, I don't want to pay the electric company's bill. They would say, what are you talking about? In the same way, I'm a citizen of the state and the citizen of the United States on separate tracks. And so no state can interfere with my federal citizenship obligations. So a state cannot absolve me of my federal citizenship. So that's really the most important point. Secession, when the theory of secession was first invented by people like John C. Calhoun, it was supposed to be a constitutionally legitimate way of a state unilaterally leaving the Union. Of course, it's nonsense because, among other things, the Constitution protects my right to travel from state to state. It says no state can deprive me of the privileges or immunities of citizenship when I travel from state to state. But if a state could unilaterally leave the Union, then that guarantee would be worthless. The state of California or whatever could just declare itself no longer in the Union and I couldn't travel to California anymore, which would violate my constitutional rights. So, yes, the federal union is irrevocable. The only way for a state to legitimately leave the Union is for the Constitution to be amended.
Thank you. And that sort of in a way leads into another one of the questions, which Brian is asking, how would your read of the Declaration of Independence inform the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions?
So I quote a line about this in my book. The Kentucky and Virginia resolutions led James Madison to make what I consider the most trenchant remark ever made about Thomas Jefferson. Madison said, "Excuses must be made for a habit in Mr. Jefferson of expressing in round terms impressions of the moment," which if you know anything about Jefferson, is absolutely the most perfect thing ever said about Jefferson. Jefferson, of course, got really worked up about the alien and sedition laws and wrote the Kentucky resolutions, which falsely claim that the Constitution is really just a treaty among sovereign states, kind of like the way the UN works today. That is incorrect. And when Madison saw Jefferson's draft of the Kentucky resolutions, he writes this note to Jefferson where he says, wait a minute, what are you talking about? And it was too late. Jefferson had already sent off the Kentucky resolutions. And Madison spent a lot of the rest of his life trying to explain that away, trying to say, no, he didn't really mean it. And with some good reason, because as I point out in the book, in fact, Jefferson on a couple of occasions claimed that even under the Articles of Confederation, a state could be compelled to obey Congress. Well, if that's true, even under the Articles of Confederation, it certainly would have been true in 1861. I think Jefferson, you know, he wasn't in Philadelphia in 1787. He had this habit of being somewhat extreme in some of the things he said, something that's not true of Madison. And so he said some things that sort of lend credence to the secessionist argument. Madison, however, quite the contrary. Madison spent his retirement years in what I consider to be a heroic effort to refute the fallacious arguments of the proto-secessionists. There's a fantastic book on this subject, by the way, I highly recommend, called The Last of the Fathers by Drew McCoy, which is about James Madison's retirement years and focuses a lot on his effort to push back against this rising secessionist movement in the 1820s and 30s.
Thank you. I'm actually going to exert a little bit of privilege and ask one of my own questions here. So I over the last semester or so, I'd recently read some Gordon Wood, and very sad to see that he recently passed away, but he sort of points out that the American founders and the patriots in the 1700s had a conception of their rights as Englishmen that was sort of taken from the radical Whiggish understanding in Britain. How does that affect your read of the Declaration of Independence? And does that undermine any of the claims that they were making in the Declaration of these abuses?
It certainly did in the eyes of the Lord North Ministry, right? So yes, it is true that the American lawyers of the time, Adams and Jefferson, you know, they cut their teeth on people like Sir Edward Coke and other Whig legal thinkers of the English and British legal tradition, and this is kind of interesting and a little bit complicated, but fascinating, I think. At one point, Lord North accused the American patriots of being Tories. And I think that's really revealing. The reason why he said that is he said the Americans have this idea that Parliament is not sovereign and that the king has some kind of sovereignty. And that was the Tory position 100 years earlier. That was the position that the word Tory originated with in the 17th century, because those are people who sided with King James and the Stuart monarchs. And at that time, the pro-freedom side was the Parliament side, the Whig side. And those terms got reversed in America because the American patriots thought that Parliament was acting the way that the Stuart monarchs had acted. And so to summarize a very complicated subject, the Americans, yeah, they looked toward the Whigs, but in Britain, that didn't make any sense. The Parliament said, well, you can't empower the king. That would be really dangerous to the Constitution. And the Americans were saying the king is the only one who can save the Constitution. And it was his failure to do so, King George's insistence on siding with Parliament, that led to independence. So, yeah, in fact, there's who was it? I can't remember the name now. The author of the idea of a patriot king, which was a popular book of the time that argued that the king's role was to adjudicate among groups in society. And that was what the Americans thought. They thought the king should stand up for them against Parliament. And the king said, no, I am merely a puppet in the hands of Parliament. They're the sovereigns. I derive my sovereignty for them, which, you know, to Americans was Toryism, to the British was Whiggism. And that's why these labels can be very confusing and unhelpful sometimes. You know, you mentioned Professor Strang, you mentioned earlier about conservative versus radical view of the revolution. You know, if you had asked John Adams and Thomas Jefferson if they were conservative, they would have said yes, because they thought they were defending the old style British common law constitutional theory of people like Sir Edward Coke, and that the parliamentary sovereignty, Parliament can do whatever it wants, Parliament can tax the colonies. They said that was a newfangled idea. That was a newcomer on the legal scene at the time. So these labels can get kind of confusing. I'm glad, by the way, that you mentioned Dr. Wood. I think we all mourn his passing. He was a real titan in American history and American constitutional history, particularly. Aside from his revolutionary stuff, his book, Empire of Liberty, the chapter on Marbury versus Madison is, in my opinion, the finest thing ever written about that case, except for the case itself.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for discussing your book here. Professor Strang, we're getting close to out of time, so I wanted to give you an opportunity if you had any parting thoughts, or Mr. Sandifer, if you have any for us.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank for the opportunity, because getting a chance to read Tim's book, it's very timely for a variety of reasons. It's well argued. It's a well put proposition for a greater role of the Declaration in American life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would like to thank both Professor Strang and Mr. Sandifer for their time today. And I'd like to thank the audience for joining and participating with some wonderful questions. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today, and we are hereby adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.